Now, one of the things happening at Electric Picnic next weekend, it's on Friday, Saturday and Sunday, as if you didn't know, and sold out. It did catch my eye because it's in Mindfield. If you know your Electric Picnic, you know where all the speaking stuff happens, I suppose I could put it that way, as opposed to the music stuff everywhere else. The talk is on youth culture of the 60s, the decade of teenagers, teddy boys, show bands, beat bands, ballrooms and bowsies, or something along those lines. The talk is part of the History Ireland Hedge School, and Tommy Graham, the editor of History Ireland, is here now. Tommy, you're very welcome to the programme.
Morning, Dave.
Will I just stick on the kettle and just wind you up and off you go?
Right, yes.
Take a look. Set the scene, will you? If we associate Ireland of the 1950s with emigration and economic failure, what then characterises the 60s? And really, if we're talking about the 60s, we're kind of talking 57 to 72, aren't we?
Yeah, we're going to. It's the long 1960s from sort of late 50s up to the sort of early 70s, you know. I suppose that the 50s get a bad rap, and that's something. I'm just wondering whether the 50s really as bad as people think, but that's another discussion. The thing about it is, if you look at the 1961 census, for example, right, it looks like Ireland has a death wish. I mean, the population is in continuous decline since the famine. If you look at 1971, then
hold on, would 61 be about half what it is now? Around two million eight hundred thousand,
roughly. Right. So it's under the 3 million now. By 1971, it's nearly 3 million people. Those two figures are the lowest population the state was ever at, and the highest population the state was ever at up to that time.
Right.
Also, by 1971, majority of people are living in towns and cities. So there's a tipping point there. More people living in towns and cities. More young people. And the big thing, of course, is the Lammas-Whittaker economic plan of the late 50s. Now,
you better give me that now in 1060s.
This is about, you know, foreign direct investment, you know, this sort of thing. I think the success of that shouldn't be exaggerated in the sense that any change to the previous disastrous economic policies probably would have looked good, but you had, you know, decent economic growth, etc., etc. Now, of course, less people are emigrating. There's a bit more unemployment by the late 60s, but not amongst the youth cohort. That's the key thing. So you have a growing youth, you know, spending section of society, and believe me, I have three teenagers, Dave. I know what that's all about, spending teenagers. So this was happening in the rest of Europe straight after the Second World War. You know, you had the post-war baby boom after 1945, peaks around 1960. Now in Ireland, that's about 20 years later. So our baby boom really doesn't start till the 60s, peaks about 1980.
Yeah.
So there's, of course, free second level education then. It comes in the 1960s. More people are going to university. So if you like, adolescence is being extended. And I think, does adolescence end at all now, Dave? I don't know.
Well, hold on. Let's even put it a different way, which is probably like a ridiculous kind of, I don't know. But like, if the Second World War ends in 1945, 10, 15 years later, you know, you never had it so good kind of stuff. And, you know, all kind of white picket fences in America, and housewives are all incredibly happy with all the utensils, all the stuff they have in the kitchen and all the rest of it, and blah, 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 and all the pictures you ever see. Is it that, like, you know, I know there was Valentino, I know there was Frank Sinatra, but there's a generation now for whom an awful lot of things are being aimed at them. Like there's a youth culture, if you like. There's a rebel without a cause.
Yeah.
There's all of these things. And suddenly, there's a huge mass market out there of people that were never targeted before.
That's right. But I think don't underestimate the continuities. There was always, there might not have been a mass market, but there always was, say, for example, a desire amongst young people for dance, right? I mean, people talk now, you know, since the 1990s with the whole rave culture and the whole kind of moral panic about these, you know, these ad hoc raves outdoors or in you know, abandoned factories or whatever, right? Now, in a way, that sort of thing's been going on for centuries. You're talking here about, you know, you're dancing at the crossroads.
Right.
I mean, people think about Comely Maids dancing at the crossroads, that thing that Dev never said, by the way, right? You know, that cliche. But these things were frowned upon by the authorities because these were young people, unregulated, outdoors, you know, getting in a trance-like state, listening to Kaylee music, whatever.
And you have whatever. Now, let's enter, if you like, the show band scene.
Yeah.
The keys to the success, the popularity. What, just to those who don't know, what are we talking about here?
Well, you see, the problem for the sort of powers that be was, how do they tame rock and roll? How do they tame Elvis? Elvis is the big thing. I mean, it cannot be underestimated worldwide.
Mm.
Now, the show bands are an attempt to tame Elvis. In other words, to give the kids rock and roll, but to give them a wholesome, clean-cut sort of a band doing it. This happens in England as well. I mean, Cliff Richard, Tommy Steele, they were all put forward as kind of safe versions of Elvis. So what the show bands did in Ireland is what everybody was doing in France. You had Johnny Halliday, whatever, you know. Well, everyone had their own.
And there had been dance bands and stuff and orchestras and stuff before that, but now there was kind of 8 6-piece bands.
This is it, yeah.
Playing usually the hits of the day, is it?
Yes, play a mixture of
their own stuff.
They're very little original stuff. Yeah. Hits of the day, country and western, folk, traditional ballads. I mean, they'd also stop dancing at a certain stage and they sing a showstopper like Jerusalem or Boule of Vogue, you know, something quite traditional. They'd all stop and gather around the stage, you know. Now, the thing is that before that, you had jazz orchestras. These would be large, you know, with brass sections, et cetera, et cetera. But the problem then is how does a sitting down jazz orchestra play rock and roll? So somebody, and the consensus seems to be, was the Clipper Carlton show band, decides to kick over the bandstands and stand up, God forbid, and start moving. And that's the genesis of the show band. And then the electric guitar comes in as well. There wouldn't have been electric guitars in the jazz bands. The jazz bands, of course, by the way, they were also frowned upon, by the church and so on. You had the famous Down with Jazz movement back in the 1930s. And I think, Dave, if something has been criticised like that, you have to assume that means it's popular.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I think there's also, I think, a healthy aspect of people in Ireland that they ignore these strictures. I mean, they sort of accept them. They don't object to them, but they just go by their merry way and ignore them. I mean, that seems to be my impression. So the jazz band stand up, kick over the bandstands, and the term show comes from the fact that it was like a little variety show, a little bit of comedy, a ballad, as I said, a bit of country and western. So they put on a show, hence a show band.
Now, there are loads of other things happening too. I mean, there was things called lounge bars where women were allowed in.
Yeah,
to drink.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
and there was a folk movement. There was a beat movement in the urban area, certainly like Limerick, Dublin, and all that kind of thing. And there was also the ballad group types, you know, the Wolf Tones, etc. That was all happening at the same time.
Yeah, you had two main alternatives to the show band scene. One was the beat bands, as you put them, and they were very much an urban based thing. But I mean, the great names, you know, of Irish rock now,
Grannies and Creatures,
the Creatures, Grannies and Tensions, and by the way, one of our speakers is John Ryan, the keyboard player with Grannies and Tensions.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember I would have seen him later with the Fly Cowboys, some of the same people in the Fly Cowboys. Pete Cummins, I think, was he Grannies and Tensions? Yeah, yeah. And Pete and John go back a long way. But you also have people who played in show bands, like Van Morrison. Served his time in a show
band. And Rory and
Rory Gallagher about the Fontana.
I think Philo was the only one who didn't.
Yeah, I mean, the point is that the thing about the show band scene, it was big business. This was properly organised. And Albert Reynolds, who just passed there recently, of course, that's where he made his first few bands.
And these guys could play.
They could play. And I'll tell you a story. My older brother Eugene, and he was into the Beatles, and to him, like, show bands were anathema, the enemy. You know, he hated them. Like, but
can I just think, you can understand that though. Can't you?
Oh yeah, because they weren't playing original stuff.
Yeah.
But the point was, that's the music he actually went to because there was nothing else.
Yeah.
But English bands, chart-topping English bands also played the show band circuit. I mean, I remember famously the Kinks played the Astoria in Bundoran in 1966. My brother was absolutely beside himself. But he said on the night he had to admit that they couldn't actually play as well as the show bands. Technically. But of course, they were playing original stuff. It was exciting and so on. So it was fantastic, you know. So there's that funny. And then you'd spin off like the Spotlight, the new Spotlight magazine. That sold 66,000 copies in 1967. This was the trade.
And it would have
magazine.
A top 10 in it and all that, which
top
is always
10.
Very important.
Actually, I just bumped into Larry.
Dates for your dancing diary.
Yeah. And by the way, I just bumped into Larry Gogan there on the way in. I mean, RTE Radio had a top 10 from 1962. I'm not sure it was Larry, was it?
But
it was.
No, I think it might have been Jimmy McGee.
It could have been anyway. Larry was there pretty close to the start of it, you know.
Yeah.
So I mean, they made a fortune. I mean, by the way, the legal framework for the ballrooms was the 1935 Public Dance Hall Act that regulated everything. No drink, you had a mineral bar. So that was the legal framework in which they operated. The beat clubs then got around that because it was a paid membership. So you had to join a beat club.
Yeah, well, wasn't Dickie Rock always saying in interviews that like the guys just got tanked up in the bars beforehand and off they came to the dances?
That's the thing. That was the thing that the girls would get in, go in when the doors opened. The band would play, sometimes play to an empty hall for about an hour. It would gradually fill up, nearly all women first of all, and then the lads wouldn't come in until closing time.
And one of the biggest things about it surely is that unlike maybe a previous decades, the youth of the day, even though there wasn't an awful lot of money, they were spending, not saving.
Oh, they were spending, not saving. I mean they were in employment. You see, this is the thing. They were in employment, and in employment throughout the country as well. It wasn't just concentrated in Dublin, you know. But the thing was, they also were working under the eye of the local parish priests, wherever, because there were, they say, more and more of them were in towns and cities, a bit more anonymity. Now, the ballad boom, going back to the ballad thing, is interesting. There's two sides to that. The ballad boom also would be associated with the folk revival in, say, Britain and America. Now, that had very much a left-wing sort of a feel to it, your Pete Seegers and so on, right? But in Ireland, it's like everywhere else, it's not quite that straightforward, because at the other end of the spectrum, within that folk scene, you have the traditional music scene, Ciolatóirí Chulainn-Éire, and the set-up in 1951. Superficially, that they tend to be a bit more conservative, you know, promoting sort of more conservative, you know, values. But, you know, you go to a FLA, like, who's to know who's the fellow with the conservative family values or who's the left winger up on the stage? Right. And you had, you know, the first record we had at home in our family was the Clancy Brothers, you know. And again, they present this clean-cut image wearing their iron jumpers. That's projected from America, right? But if you wanted something a bit beerier, you went for the Dubliners. Right. Now, the Dubliners were criticised at the time the same way as the Pogues were later criticised, you know, that you're messing up our musical heritage, etc., etc. But it's massively popular, you know. And then, of course, the Dubliners famously appeared on Top of the Pops, 1967, I think, with Seven Drunken Nights.
Yeah.
And we were all torn between kind of pride of, you know, an Irish band being
on
Top of the Pops.
No, I wasn't torn between. That was one of the worst pieces of
Well, you know, it's a shame,
that.
You know. I mean, I'm sure people have heard. I mean, they only sang five of them.
All right.
They only sang five verses, thank God.
They were banned, I think, from the other two, all right, let's just say a blast of just what people might necessarily know. You haven't mentioned just a few things yet, the church or Brendan Boyer. Let's give you a little blast of Brendan. FM. That's the Huckle Buck from Brendan Boyer. Now, by the way, we did mention the Beat Groups as well, so just give it a little bit of a blast of the innocence of it, I suppose, in some ways. A little bit of, how about grannies? Grannies Intentions, never an everyday thing. Not very Beat Groupy, this.
Just take whatever you like. But baby, it's not like they say. This love doesn't come every day. Living is one thing, but loving is something. You can't let the chance slip away.
Never an everyday thing indeed, Granny's Intentions. Johnny Doohan, we're just talking about there, writing again in the Sunday Independent today about the lack of Irish music on the radio. That's from a long time ago. That's like just an example of two sides of things, I suppose. You're going to mention there, by the way, Tommy Graham, we're talking here, the History of Ireland Head School Electric Picnic next weekend is what we're talking about. And you're going to be there doing all this, and you're main invigilator or whatever the word
is. I'll be on the bill along with Blondie and
right,
you know, whatever, okay. Portishead, all those other people.
Yeah, they get Beck's opinion on it. Okay, listen, you just mentioned there about radio being important, and that's the wrong word. It's not radio, it's transistor.
Transistor radio, exactly, Dave, because,
God's
I mean, I can just about remember the old valve radios, the steam radio, big, huge, boxy thing, you know, and of course the thing about that is you had to listen to it along with your family. The transistor, on the other hand, is a tiny little thing, you know. I mean, I remember, again, my older brother Eugene at boarding school, you know, walking around with the lizard in his ear.
Portable.
Batteries, yes, and the batteries run out. I can't even listen to under the covers. You know, people listen to Radio Luxembourg, you know, all the pirate stations, or Caroline. That's what gave the Dubliners, by the way, Seven Drunken Nights.
Yeah,
the
Caroline being 1967, that was whatever it was,
mid-60s, yeah.
And then the BBC Radio 1 was 1967, so this was all happening. Yeah, and the point FM about, radio in America, 66.
Yeah, the thing is, it's also tuning people's ear. So that, and one of the weaknesses of the show band scene in Ireland is that they did record, but the standard was pretty crap, you know.
So they were better live.
They were better live, right? Mm. So the standard wasn't great. And the thing is, the standard that people wanted then was the bar was getting higher and higher because people were listening now.
But were
the
they
radio.
Breaking down loads of barriers for the simple reason that instead of the emigration of previous decades, we're talking here about a successful industry and nobody was able to deny that, not even the church who tried to control it all.
Yeah, no, the church, I mean, that's this the thing. And I think that, I suppose that my older brother and myself, I would have been always slightly cringed at show bands, but looking back now I can see that this, whether we like it or not, this was what we produced. And I think that there aren't these strict dividing lines. You know, we mentioned, you know, Van Morrison, Rory Gallagher, right? The point was that there was the cross fertilisation between these different scenes. I mean, Horse Tips would be the classic case, you know.
That would be between 70 and 80, yeah.
In the early 70s when they started off, right? Now, I know Eamon Carr hates this when I say it to him, but I've said it to him, you know, Eamon, you know, maybe Horse Tips was just a show band by another name. Oh, he nearly killed me. But you know, but they played the show band circuit, the ballroom circuit,
yeah.
And you know, that was something that always puzzled me. How come uniquely they're the only kind of but
they broke
feeder.
Down every second door because of that.
Yeah, yeah. But the point is, as I said, the Kinks played the Astoria as well in '60s, so they weren't, you know, maybe as cutting edge.
Just
as
go
as
to the
think.
Ballrooms themselves and just what they were around the country in terms of show bands, and get back to the church as well. The ballrooms were closed for 40 days of Lent, weren't they?
That's right. Lent, and of course this is a major hassle if you're a professional musician, right? So they used to decamp to England. They'd do a season in England, and usually the managers would fill in those dates first because that was the dodgy, that was the down time. So they'd make sure they had work over Lent. The other thing is in Bundoran again, that's it's down the road from where I'm from, Ballyshannon, that's part of the Diocese of Clogher. I can remember famously or infamously the Bishop of Clogher, Dr. Eugene O'Callaghan, I never forget his name, issued an edict that all dances on Saturdays had to finish at midnight because if they continued into the Sabbath they would be an occasion of sin.
Absolutely, he's so, right. Yeah,
and that was that. That
was
implemented.
Joint Lenten pastoral of the four archbishops. Did you know that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and people used to read them. Used to appear in the newspapers. Yeah. You know. Yeah, yeah. It's different days entirely. Now, the thing is, I think there was a certain complacency in the show band scene in that they thought that they would continue forever because all they had to do was to imitate the latest
thing. Well, see,
this
is the whole thing. Like, which was the most important thing? To produce an original record and put on a good show? Put on a good show, wasn't it?
Yeah,
that was... just doing it live and without looking to see the forces or whatever. Because you mentioned Elvis there. And Elvis, like, is 54 to 58 when he went into the army. And as John Lennon famously said, Elvis died when he went into the army.
That's right, yes.
And then it was all dying out, all this stuff. And there was just crooner-type people coming along in America.
Yeah.
And it was Neil Sedaka who was writing stuff. I remember he was saying the fact that the Beatles came along and destroyed everything in terms of us songwriters, Carole King, Jerry Goffin, etc., because these guys were cool, they were making statements, they defined culture, and that's what the Beatles did. So by the time 64, 65, 66, 67 happened, there was all this stuff happening in Britain too and happening in America, and the show bands were playing all that music from there.
Yeah.
The only time anybody here could see it or hear it, except for your Kinks or Who now and again who might have come, was show bands.
That's right. But the thing is that what's happening is a native rock scene is developing, though. This would be my contention. This is providing the raw materials or the building blocks of it. There are a few setbacks, though. I think the decision of RTE, for example, to rebroadcast Top of the Pops in the 1970s, I mean, that completely wiped out any Irish top 10, you know. But I think, though, there's a few ironic twists in this. I mean, many people see the Miami Showband Massacre as the sort of the literal and figurative
what,
end.
What, 75?
75. This would be the autumn 75 of Fran O'Toole and people were murdered by loyalist paramilitaries. And up to that time, show bands just ignored the Troubles. It was an all-island, cross-community people, you know, they'd play to different audiences. In fact, sometimes, and this became a bit of a difficulty once the Troubles started, fellas would look around saying, what do we play tonight? Is it the Queen or Aaron Levine, right?
Yeah.
And if you played the wrong one, you'd be in trouble. But I think that the writing was on the wall already because you mentioned there about the lounge bars. I mean, the point is, in the old days, the lads would tank up in the bars and then meet the girls later at the dance hall. But the point was, what was the point point in going to the dance hall if the girls were already in the lounge bar with you and you could listen to a beat band or a trad or ballad group? Because the ballads tend to be in the pubs, the beat bands in the beat clubs, right? But I think that the lounge bar and women coming into lounge bars, as we all know, of course, brought civilization as we know it to an end.
The beginning of the end.
That was the beginning of the end, really. Because they and you know, the people are into more self-expression, not just entertainment, right? Now, the other thing about the Miami, and I heard Billy McGrath argue this very persuasively. Billy, you know Billy well. He was the entertainment officer in UCD.
I know him very well.
And he said one of the problems was that after Miami, entertainment officers or even your local, they could not
had
book.
Had to go for the locals.
They had to go for the locals,
which
right?
Was good
and
for
I
the
remember,
locals.
Dave, I mean, when you first started broadcasting, late 70s, brilliant time in Dublin. I mean, there was music everywhere. I mean, as I say, there was some fantastic music, there was some really bad music as well, right? Mm. But there was just lots of it. And in ad hoc little venues, it was brilliant. I mean, I thought that, I mean, maybe that's because that was the year when I was a teenager, but I remember Dublin was hopping.
It took time for bands to come.
Yeah. And many of the early bands didn't last the pace. In fact, there was a whole new lot of bands coming in the 80s then, right? Yeah. But the whole, say, U2 thing and all that, these things weren't built on nothing, you know. So I would contend that that whole industry, that whole template was there, you know.
But getting back to the show bands then, like, I mean, like, they were a national phenomenon. And are we talking here, I want to get, like, national pride as well. There was a really big, like, the Eurovision Song Contest.
Yes.
The Top of the Pops, as you mentioned.
Yes.
The Spotlight magazine selling 66,000 copies. It was a big scene. I mean, it was a big and important thing. And dances down the country, 2,000 to 3,000 people, no problem.
No, massive. I mean, there was one in this is in London, I can't remember the name of the place, but, like, some 6,000 people. People. I mean, that's just amazing. Like, I mean, I don't know.
And there were documentaries on television in the 60s too, which showed that these guys, like, in, say, you know, a Dickie Rock band or something, they were normal people.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
playing cards on the bus.
I can't remember the name of that talk. Yes, they were presented as good family lads, you know, going back to their wives and girlfriends at the end of it. And of course, by the way, of course, it was a hard life. These guys were on the road. And, you know, if you played, say, Bundoran, you couldn't go down the road and play Ballyshannon.
So you had to
drive another 50 miles
and then back up a few days later.
Yeah, so you're zigzagging around the place, you know. Yeah. And then, you know, fellas, you know, would obviously take a few drinks or whatever. That took its toll, you know. So it was a tough life, you know. But they reckon most of the money was made by the ballroom owners, the promoters, right, at that stage, you know. But
was there a difference in the mid-60s between the Beatles and the Stones in terms of the perception here in Ireland?
In terms of what the effect might have had.
The Stones was a step too far, wasn't it?
Oh, they were. I remember my brother, you know, again, he was a Beatles man, you know. He always went, why do the Stones not smile, you know? These kind of scowling guys. Same with The Who, you know.
I mean, this is hard to believe,
like, but apparently B.P. Fallon interviewed Pete Townsend for New Spotlight 1966, and Pete Townsend was very forthcoming about, you know, he took a few pills and
By the way, happy birthday, Beep. I think it's his birthday today.
To Pete Townsend, it's his birthday.
No,
okay.
No, Beep.
Oh, Beep's birthday, even more. Yes.
He'll be at the picnic next weekend.
Well, I tell you what, I must check this one, because according to Carol Houlihan, she's the academic we have in our panel, she quotes Beep as having, you know, mixed feelings about publishing this interview with Pete Townsend because he talks about his drug habit. I don't know if Beep would take the same view now, right? But again, innocent days, you know. So And by the way, I mean, you talk about drug scene, there was no drug scene. I mean, there was two arrests, two people charged in 1965 for drug offences. In 1966, it was one. The following year, it was none, you know. So this was just a moral panic. The point was...
If you were that one person from 66,
yeah, who's that
51552, get in touch now. At Dave Fanning Show, send us a tweet. I'll tell you what, look, I want to any excuse to go back. This is ridiculous. Tenuous Connection, number 47. But I want to play The Beatles Arriving at Dublin Airport. I can quote this off by heart. I'll just give you a little bit... Frank Hall, take it away.
Listen, what are you doing down here? Like,
I'm here to see the Beatles, of course.
I know you are, but what particular...
The Beatles, they're great. Their hairstyle, their coats, their jackets, their leather jackets, they're fabulous.
Yes.
Terrific, the sensation. Fashion.
What are you doing here?
I'm just waiting for Paul McCartney to come.
Yeah, well, what is it about these fellas that has you down here being tortured? What are you doing here?
I think they're marvellous.
Oh, just a minute. But they're only lads. They're only schoolboys.
Oh, they're only lads. Terrific.
Please. Now, what time did you take up your position here today?
About 1:15.
Yeah. And what is it about these fellas that brings you out at that hour of the day?
No, they're just gorgeous.
They're what?
They're gorgeous.
Well, now, be a bit more explicit. I mean, what is it? Is it the singing or the hair or what?
The singing and the hair and the jackets.
And is that all?
No, everything, I don't know. I really sing and everything.
Well, what about you?
I like the way they sing.
The way they sing? What way do they sing? I've never heard them.
They have a great beat, clever song.
What, like what, I mean? Give us a sort of an
like,
idea.
Like, do you love me? Or,
like what?
She loves you, where is that? She loves you. Yeah.
Yeah.
She loves you.
Yeah, and you love them?
Yes.
Oh, you do, you do. What about you, ladies?
I just like them.
You just like them? Yeah. You're not mad about them?
No, I'm not mad about them.
Well, you have no right to be here at all.
Oh, then I like them, then I'm mad about them.
And what about you?
I don't like them.
You don't? Well, thank goodness for that. Well, what are you doing here?
We're getting tickets for next week for Helen Shapiro.
Oh. Very good. And that's it. Whatever it is. My sympathies are with the girl who's booking for Helen Shapiro. And this is good night. And for all I know, it's goodbye.
So, you know, there's a funny thing about that. There's a lot of funny things about that, actually. That's Frank Hall interviewing Beatles peoples when they came to Dublin, 63, 64, whatever it was back then. Now, the point about it is that, like, Frank Hall there was about 40 years of age or so, which is pretty astonishing when you think about it, because there's nobody at 40 now who'd be doing that who wouldn't want to be seen to be down with the kids.
Yeah.
He's specifically doing a generation gap and proud of it kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, like, is that it? So, like, you know, the adults responding to the new forms of youth culture. How did they respond? Is Frank a representative sample there?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing about the Beatles is that, I mean, I remember in our household, you know, even my parents liked them. I mean, they liked the music. I mean, I think the Beatles are an exception. Maybe just because I'm from a Beatles household, but to me they are you know, a separate entity altogether in terms of the quality.
The Stones crossed the line.
But I mean, remember the Beatles? You look at the Beatles' first album, and half it's covers. Like, you know, so there, right. The Beatles. I mean, the Beatles went to Hamburg and did what the show bands did. They gigged every night. They honed their skills. So, you know, so in many ways, the Beatles were a show band in a way in their early days. Right now, funny, going back to New Spotlight magazine wasn't particularly impressed by the Beatles. You know, said that, you know. Quirky sense of humour, you know, nice clothes, but tend to shout into the microphone, they weren't impressed at all, you know.
But would the powers that be a little bit scared of the stuff that we mentioned earlier on in terms of the beat scene in some ways, because this was like the counterculture, if you like, middle class university students,
yes,
which couldn't be controlled as easily.
Yeah, that was the thing, but that's what the show bands were designed to bottle,
yeah,
you know.
Exactly.
But of course they couldn't bottle it, that was the thing, you know, or it ended up in different bottles, if you know what I mean. So that's what the show band scene was to that we have something different, that we've kind of squared the circle here, bridged the generation gap, you know. And I suppose then the people of Frank Hall's age group, they were coining it, they were making the money, the Albert Reynolds and so on, you know, were the ones who benefited from it. So I think that, I suppose in a way, that the show band scene was like the cultural expression, the popular cultural expression of the whole Lamass Whitaker economic expansion kind of idea, you know. That's what it represented.
And the actual dance halls, just to get back to it, and the show bands, etc., and that. I mean, these were places that were like giving massive employment right,
yes,
across the board in terms of local villages, towns, etc.
Oh yeah, I mean, think of the musicians, the tailors, yeah, the printers, you know, hotels, you know, restaurants. I mean, it was a massive industry.
And the visible youth subculture of it all. I mean, like emigration, the big thing was here that emigration was stemmed, the tide. Like, I mean, an awful lot. I mean, obviously compared to the 50s and 60s, it certainly was.
Yeah.
Like, just in general, in your average family, they might have seen it, that while the older three went away, these three could stay
at home. No, they're at home and they're in employment. And as I said at the start there, the youth do better. They're not as badly affected by the unemployment that comes on the scene by the late 60s, you know. So they have money in their pockets and they want to spend it. You know?
The bad press that show bands can sometimes get, which is it had to, in terms of the newer music, to seem cool, they had to slag the previous one. I mean, even up to 77, 78, you have Geldof and the Late Late bemoaning, yeah, the fact that he grew up in an Ireland that dared have a show band within 40 feet of him, kind of thing. You can understand that, though, surely.
Yeah, yeah, yes. I mean,
and the way music was going.
Yeah, I absolutely. Except, though, I think that, you know, it's useful if people recognise where their heritage comes from, you know, and not just sort of ignore it. Also, I think, though, that nowadays, you know, I don't think people, you say, if my own son's generation would have this type of discussion. In other words, they're quite, they don't see any big difference between an Irish band and a non-Irish band. Mm. And I'm not sure even that they're particularly impressed if they're on a TV show or whatever. I mean, Top of the Pops is gone now anyway. It's this thing, the whole landscape has changed, you know. So the thing is, we have a music scene here. Nobody makes a big deal about an Irish band particularly. It's a question of whether they're good or not. you know, not, not where they're from, you know.
Funny thing about Top of the Pops is just the name of it. It is so your uncool granddad came up with that name, and a throwback. I mean, up to the 90s it was on Top of the Pops.
Well, I mean, the thing is, and the other thing is, music is much more atomized now. It's broken down in small sort of subsections, you know.
But when it was breaking down, just going back to that Beat Club stuff or whatever it happens to be, wasn't it true that, like, you know, in the north and south sides of Limerick and Dublin, etc., in the suburbs, there were tennis clubs and things, and there was the genesis of those things.
Yeah, that's the thing. And again, because of they could get around the law. You see, you had to have a dance license if there was dancing. That was the thing, you know. But they could, because they were a club. But that's where the beat bands played. You know, in the '60s and seventies, they were the outlet.
Right, I'll just give you the chosen few of one of them, and the guard, they accused them of playing, I have this here, look, music that incited sex, rape and indecency.
God forbid, you know. I mean, if you want to get an impression of what this looks like, I'd recommend people, there's a DVD called Rocky Road to Dublin. This was a documentary made in 1968, filmed in 1967. Now, it doesn't cover the show band scene because it's Dublin centred, but there is a scene there from a beat club. Now, it's not a live band, it's a guy playing records, but if you look at the style of the people there, you know, as my father used to say, all the boys have long hair and all the girls have short hair, you know, but they're very up to the mark. This is not some hick, unfashionable place, you know. So I think we can hold our heads up high that, you know, the beat clubs of Dublin were just as hip as the beat clubs
elsewhere.
Were you
in beat clubs in Dublin? Were you?
No, I wasn't.
Beat clubs in Donegal.
I came of age during the whole new wave punk scene in the late 70s, Dave. You know, and listen to yourself, of course, as well on the radio.
All right. Well, listen. We'll give a blast here to the Creatures. Just a tiny bit of Turn Out the Light.
I really gotta know. Okay, you say you'll never let me go on our special night, holding me tight. Turn out the light, turn out the light, dear. Let's see what you can do. You say all right, dear. I'm gonna take my cue, 'cause I really gotta know. Okay, you say you'll never let me go on our special night, holding me tight.
That's pretty cool, all right, you know, isn't it? I wouldn't say the pulpit like that today.
No, you know, let's see what you can do. Turn out the light, dear. I'll take my cue from you. Like, he's been very polite now, right? But those kind of lyrics would have struck fear into the hearts of parents the length and breadth of the country, you know?
Yeah.
And the clergy
Creatures,
as well.
Yeah. Larry, are you? Did you ever play the Creatures on the radio? Just come in for a second. The usual Larry in for a second situation on the radio. Larry, say hello to Tommy. I think you met him upstairs, did you? Larry, do you remember all the... Were you allowed to play the Creatures and all the people I just mentioned, Granny's Intentions and all the rest?
Oh, Granny's Intentions, yeah. Never an Everyday Thing was a great...
Yeah, I just played a bit of that. Never an Everyday Thing.
You did, of course, play them, yeah.
Did you get into any trouble about playing stuff on the radio, no?
I was always in trouble, Dave. You're playing too... The stuff is too noisy, you're playing,
The noisy one, there was a thing I see in Dunleary here or something like that, where the locals complained because at the local yacht club or some club they were playing music and it rattled the cups and saucers on our tables, so they had to stop doing putting
that'd
on
terrible,
bands. That'd be terrible, wouldn't it, indeed, yeah. Well, listen, I'll tell you what, Larry, is Larry not in the... You're not in the panel next week at the...
No,
the,
are you at the picnic?
But no, I'm not. No.
Oh, okay.
So he's not going to be on the panel. Okay, well, the panel is... Let's get this right here. First of all, this podcast, History Festival of Ireland, Carlo, Dancing with the Sea, The Rise and Fall of the Show.
No, these are podcasts on our website. So I've done this discussion in different forms of this.
Right.
And it's always different every time I do it, depending on the panellists and so on, right? There's a couple things on our website. But the other thing, I'm the Rocky Road to Dublin is a great documentary, just to give you a flavour. And by the way, it wasn't banned. Worse, it was ignored at the time. You know, it was just kind of assigned to oblivion, you know.
All right, come on, Larry. Thank you very much.
See you, Larry.
Larry, don't forget now, in the Golden Hour, you better play some Granny's Intentions there, all the Creatures. I've got Brendan Boyer there as well.
But there's a website as well, a guy called Jerry Gallagher, irish-showbands.com. Absolutely brilliant. I mean, just a mind, you know, of a cornucopia of little factoids on the whole scene.
Okay, and there's Jerry Smith, Noisy Ireland, A Short History of Irish Popular Music.
Yep.
And Peter Lennon, Rocky Road to Dublin.
That's the DVD. You
that's
get that
from
in the
67, 68, is it?
It's filmed in 67, right? Mm. I mean, it was very controversial at the time, you know, because critical of the church and so many. You look back at it now, it's kind of really kind of nostalgic almost. The star of that particular show was Father Michael Cleary, you know, which is kind of poignant given it.
The what singing, we now priest.
Know, singing priest. The priest who was a father in more ways than one, that was the other thing. So, yeah, on the panel, by the way, for discussion, we have John Ryan, Farmer's Granny's Intentions that I mentioned. We've Neil Toner, of course, at this parish. We'll be filling us in the folk scene. And then we've Carla Holohan. She's the academic she's bringing a book out on it next year. And then we have Donal Fallon. I don't know if you know Donal. He's the one of the editors of the Come Here To Me blog, which is a kind of mixture of kind of left-wing politics, 70s music and League of Ireland football. Marvellous.
Right,
mixture.
Brilliant. Okay, well, then that is, I might be there long there myself. Minefield next Saturday afternoon at Electric Picnic, and you got to find yourself
about three o'clock. You know, just when you're kind of chilling out from the other music. You
youth
know.
Culture of the 1960s is what we're talking about here. That's great. Listen, Tommy, thank you very much.
Thanks,
Dave, for dropping in. I'm just wondering, should I be doing a bit? I could play a bit of Seven Drunken Nights, but I absolutely hear it. I played 5 seconds.
Name of this song is
don't like it. Sorry, we go on to something else. How about Joe Dolan? You're something. No, how about Skid Row? First Thing in the Morning.